This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
This is Jimmy Carboni, the host of Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I've been a part of the HRN community for 10 years. After all that time, I'm constantly inspired by the incredible voices of our network. Each week, I record my show in the HRN studio because I'm excited to bring you, our listeners, the most important stories from the world of beer, food, cider, and more. All of us here at HRN make food radio because we love it. This year, HRN is celebrating its 10th anniversary, but we need your support to keep food radio going strong for the next decade. Join the HRN community today by becoming a member. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate right now. You can even show some love for my show by selecting Beer Sessions in the designation drop-down menu. Thanks for listening to HRN. Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Hey guys, it's Tuesday, June 11th, 2019. This is a special show. Today we're going to be talking about cider. Our good buddy Andy Brennan of Aaron Burr Cider has written a book called Uncultivated, Wild Apples, Real Cider, and the Complicated Art of Making a Living. And I think it's a big deal. I think it's a big deal for the world of food and beverage, and in particular, cider. So we put together a show today. We're going to introduce ourselves because there's some very interesting people from the cider world here that many of you may not know, but you all should know. So let's start with the editor.
I'm Ben Watson. Good to see you again, Jimmy. I edited Andy's book, but I'm also a longtime cider fancier. Wrote a book about 20 years ago now, believe it or not, called Cider Hard and Sweet, and it's still in print, third edition. And I'm active with lots of other things like Cider Days, Franklin County Cider,
Massachusetts. Yeah, yep.
First weekend in November, 25th anniversary.
Great stuff. We had you on in 2015. A really nice show. It's great to have you back.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
And a cider influencer turned cider maker.
I am Ron Sansone. I am a cider maker from Connecticut, Spoken Spy Cider Works in Middletown, cider journalist.
And you brought us some of your ciders.
I brought some cider too, a Kingston Black single varietal that was a best in class at Glen Cap.
That's great, man. There's a lot to talk about in the show, but we're going to skirt over the book a little bit, but mostly talk about what's in our glass and a little bit of cider world. And the author himself.
I'm Andy Brennan. I am the farmer, founder, and fermenter of Aaron Burr Cidery, which is 75 miles north and west, just as you enter the Catskills. And we have a little homestead farm, and we produce a small amount of cider. But let me just say I'm honored to be here with the three of you. So thanks for having me on.
Well, it's great. Last time we were with you on the radio, we went up to your place in Worsboro in Sullivan County, New York. We did On the Road with Beer Sessions Radio. And the theme of that region's episode was called Edge of the Wild. As we drove up, we felt that wildness. You know, you talk about wild apples, but just tell us, like, in your words, you know, what is your part of Sullivan County? Why would I say it's on the edge of the wild?
Well, there is a ridge which separates the Catskills from Sullivan County, and that ridge really does act as an edge. And as you could even see this from Google Earth, it's you've got this heavily populated New York metropolitan area, and then there's a ridge, which I am behind, and then you've got the wilds of the Catskills. So it's, I feel like where I live is between two worlds.
No, we drove up there, and we felt it right away, and it called to us the edge of the wild. I mean, when we first met, you know, I think you told me, might have been 2010 or 2011, you said one of the first times you tasted cider in New York City was for a slow food event at my old pub.
It was your old pub, yes, and it was, for a fact, if you're fact-checking, that is true. My first public appearance is at Jimmy's down in that back room there.
Yeah, and you're a good arc for me of the whole cider industry and the cider revival in the Northeast. Just tell us about that time. You know,
you're going to get the book, people, Uncultivated. So you can read the whole story. It's a well-written book. It's kind of like as much of a novel as a less of a how-to make cider book. But let's just talk, since you're here, that when was it, 2010? First time you publicly tasted cider. What was going through your head, and what were you serving then?
Well, 2010, there weren't but I think six cider producers in all of New York State, which is now we're like at something 140 or something. But I had gone to visit my wife's family in the same town that Ben Watson lives, and I was clued. Oh, I hear something. I was clued into Cider Days event, which occurs in November, and that was my first real experience seeing, you know, hundreds of amateur cider makers and some professional gathered together and really celebrating what I think is the apple life. And if I can make one point, and I'll say it over and over, that I think cider is really just a small part of the apple life, and I felt that then, and it's growing, that little culture. It's growing.
So the whole arc of this cider revival back to 2010. So Ben, you know, you're involved with the Franklin County, it's in Massachusetts, Cider Days. You'll be celebrating the 25th anniversary this year. What was it like back then in 2010? I mean, it's been going on for many years already.
A lot of it is similar. I mean, when it first started, it was much more of an amateur focused competition, people who were learning how to make cider. And a lot of those people ended up becoming commercial cider makers, actually. But the great thing about it is that the event's always been mostly educational or tour related or promoting agriculture. And it's Franklin County, for those people who don't know it, it's the least populated and most rural county in Massachusetts. And it's also the most bluest county in Massachusetts, which is really saying something. But it's a great place, and it's just filled with orchards, and it started this whole cider revival. It's really sort of the epicenter of that in the country. And it's always been something that we wanted to have as a lot of free events, you know, workshops and presentations from people who are experts. And gradually, people have come in who've been commercial cider makers, and they've started participating in it too, like the big grand tasting that we do, which is the biggest event during the weekend, the Cider Salon. That was my coinage back in, like, I think 2006 or something. It's just a special event. It's different. I don't quite know how to explain it other than that, but it's different from any other cider tasting event, like the Cider Summits and the
I'll say that things. I think that you've got it. When people say Cider Days, the people that have been there know what it is, and I love it. And we're just giving you a shout out for that. But we're going to move on. And Ron, you know, you're a cider influencer first and a writer.
Yep.
Tell us about when you first met Andy. We're trying to like tell the arc of Andy's. Cider making.
First met Andy, it was probably in your place, down in Jimmy's. So, tasting in the back room, Cider Week. In New York City, Cider Week has been pretty important.
And anything you want to say about the ciders you tasted from him?
Or? That was probably
his impact 4,000 cider
ciders ago. But definitely, his ciders were amazing.
So, well, you know, it does feel like that. And Ben, probably in your eyes, I mean, 4,000 ciders ago, but you know, 2011 was the first Cider Week in New York, and things were just coming together, the Apple projects and other things. But it's changed so much and so quickly. And Andy, just bring it to 2011, 2012. You know, the ciders that you were making. In the book, it talks about your struggles with trying to grow certain apple trees and your love for wild apples. But what were you making in 2011, 2012? And you know, where were you getting those apples from?
Well, 2012 is famous amongst Northeast orchardists as a frost year. So there were no apples to use that year. That's something one needs to know about apples, isn't that sometimes your star takes the year off. And 2011, I was still making cider in my basement, which is size of the studio here with a 5-foot ceiling and a dirt floor. And I was basically an amateur cider maker. I still kind of am. And I just got my license then, and I was selling, I think, 150 gallons that year, which was all, you know, carboys. And little by little, we've grown. And then we peaked in 2015, which, just as there's years where there are no apples, there are years when there's too many. And 2015 was one of those. So we're sort of in between those two now.
And your take on things a little different. I mean, again, you got to get the book Uncultivated because it explains a lot. I mean, I've known you long enough to know what to expect, you know, from what's in your glass. And I've been to, you know, to your farm, so I know your approach. Let's talk about your philosophy of apples, wild apples, seedlings. You know, there's one technique where you spread the pomace from your pressed apples on the ground to see what grows. Let's talk a little bit about that, and your other guests can join in. I call you the apple tree whisperer.
To sum it up would be impossible. I mean, really, for me, it's a religion that's gone back hundreds of years. It's not a religion, but it's a people have been spreading seeds and growing apples from seed since this nation was founded, and. Everyone knows Johnny Appleseed, but he was really, 200 years into an American tradition, which had literally started at the Mayflower.
Yeah. Ben?
Yeah, this is Ben. I was just going to add that, one of the things that I wrote in my book, The Cider Hard and Sweet, is I had a lot of history in that book, and a lot of the reason for that was because people couldn't import trees successfully in the days of sailing ships from England in the early colonial days. And there were some very wealthy people who did that, but most people grew them because they were growing them for cider. They recognized the value of seedling trees. And so farmers would have these apple trees on their farm, and they would, after they pressed cider, like Andy said, would spread out the pomace and the seeds on the ground in nursery rows. And literally it was like an enormous nationwide agricultural experiment. And some of our amazing eating apples and other kinds of apples that have persisted to this day came up as chance seedlings from these, just these farmer researchers, really, in the 19th century and before.
If I might say, since we are at the edge of the Newtown Creek, one of the most famous pippins was born right here in Queens, or on the border of Brooklyn and Queens, and that's the Newtown pippin, which is still heavily cultivated in some areas, like in California.
And it's now being recultivated on Roosevelt Island, too, right?
Is it for real?
Yeah, I think they planted some trees out there a few years ago to try to, because it is the New York City apple, right near the Gowanus Canal.
Yeah, and tell me the year. It's 17 something.
At least. I don't know that anybody really knows it because it is a pippin. It's a seedling variety.
Yeah. I mean, we've covered a lot of this kind of the evolution of cider revival in New York is kind of amazing, and we've done some shows about single varietal Kingston Blacks. I still think most people don't really know about any of that stuff. But Andy, your take is a little different. I mean, are you going for the single varieties, or are you only really focusing on the wild apples and seedlings? Because I think you actually have to propagate. If you want a varietal, you have to propagate it. Why don't you talk to us about that, and that process?
Okay. Well, I'm not so interested in single variety ciders. It's not even an option for me. The way I get my apples is by foraging mostly, and I do have an orchard, but it's the orchard is essentially it's an orphanage of graftwood that I'm collecting in the wild, and every tree is different. So of the 350 trees I have in my orchard, they're all grafted, and some of them grafted twice. So I have 500 varieties, and it wouldn't make sense to to make single varieties.
But when we talk about these single varieties and Newtown, you know, Pippin and all the stuff, someone actually is grafting them and propagating it. But that's, I want to put that out there, but I want you to say that you're not doing that.
Okay, I'm not doing that. and I
this is a deep book, guys. We got to flush it out. Come on.
I'm not doing that, and I'm not doing it and for a reason. Because it relates to my apple spirituality that the apple is an extremely diverse and complicated species, and in fact, much more so than us humans, genetically. And the apple wants to create lots of different varieties, and I want to assist in that process rather than sort of reduce that process or aid in the I like this term because I hear it all the time now, the monetization, but essentially the commoditizing of a particular varieties. It doesn't suit my purposes, and historically it hasn't. And they've always said variety or diversity as much as possible.
In the book, it says you tried that. When you first started, what, you went and bought certain single varietals, and they didn't really work.
They don't really work, although there are some varieties which I can't deny. They make good cider. They're rare. We're drinking a Kingston Black at the moment, which is a variety famous for being single variety. Here in New York, there are some varieties. Golden Russet is thought to be. I somewhat disagree, but. One of the few apples out of literally millions that can diverse enough that one could make an interesting drink out of it.
And then, Ron, you're making cider, so we're drinking your Kingston Black. Tell us about your cider.
The Kingston Black apple has a lot of complexity that just regular Colony apples wouldn't have. So I think blends are very important, what Andy's talking about, finding apples that work together. But... Some apples work on their own, and this is one.
But still, mostly, the trend in the cider industry is that, what are we doing? We're trying to figure out what varieties work, and people are propagating them and trying to plant them. I know some guys in the Pacific Northwest are planting like 40,000 trees or something. Ben, do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I mean, I also wanted to mention on the Kingston Black, it's always amazing to me how different ciders taste made by different people from Kingston Black. We had a workshop that I think Darlene Hayes led a couple of years ago at Cider Days, and it was a horizontal tasting of Kingston Blacks. And we had done it before several years ago with like three producers, and she had five or six. It really depends on where the apples are grown. Apples are so affected by terroir or local conditions, and Andy can talk way more to this, but it makes a huge difference, but so does the way that you're, you know, making the cider. And I could come down and look at Ron's operation, and I could see exactly what he's doing, and I could do it exactly the same way with apples that I'm either growing or even ones that I'm buying. If he were growing, I'm buying from him. And I would have something that would taste very different from this. It really is amazing how variable it can be.
Andy, what are ciders that you drink? You know, you got turned on, and again, to the book, I'm trying to promote the book, Uncultivated. You got turned on years ago you tasted some Farnham Hill ciders. What are ciders that you actually like and drink? You can be blunt.
Okay, I'm going to answer that, but I want to just say one thing, I think, in continuation of what Ben was saying, and this is, I think, an easy way for the layperson to think of cider, in that it's made by three species, right? There's the yeast, the apple, and the human, and I'd like to think that that none of them are really dominant, but if any, the apple should be dominant. I wanted to throw that out there. I think of that as a sort of easy way to introduce people to cider, that there's
We know that in the world of wine, people talk about the fruit and terroir, and that's kind of been pretty classic understanding for a long time now.
Yeah.
So you're talking about cider the same way.
Ideally, all three of those live a similar life or practice. This is where I feel like I've been so influenced by apples I want to emulate the way they've sort of acclimated to different areas, and that just sort of affects the way I make cider too, as a my relationship with yeast, for instance. Sort of cultivating yeast, but sort of uncultivating it as well.
No, it's good. We can go really deep, but I want to just go back to a couple of things. In the book, you talked about when you first got this farm, the former owner told you about economy of the place. And part of your journey was where you've come to as a cider maker, as a farmer. You figured out kind of like what you could do with the farm that you were on.
Okay, well, I'm still one question back. West County and Farnham Hill were hugely influential for me. What's the next question?
I don't know. Economy of place from your book. This is his first radio interview for the book.
If you haven't figured it out. So I live on a farm which is historically a homestead farm, and they had dating back and. By the way, Aaron Burr was the lawyer on the deed of the Homestead Farm in 1817. It was sold from Bayard, which is another famous New York family, broken into a small piece bought by the Browns, who are a family who owned my farm between 1817 and 1906. And they were basically, you know, little diversified farms like you see all over New England. And I know they had a horse, they had a sleigh, they had, I'm assuming, a cow, maybe chickens. Actually, I know they had chickens. And they tapped their maple trees. And of course, cider was part of that life. You know, I've been living there 12 years, and I'm just like a freshman, understanding the genius of that system. I'll be there in my next 12 years, maybe I'll be a sophomore. But it's really a brilliant, way of life. I mean, just the farm, the way it was set up, from the rock walls to everything, there's nothing that's, not considered.
You know, you've also talking about small businesses and communities and subsistence farming. And I know there's a movement. There's a book I read, Michael Foley, a farming book. He talks about the idea that what's wrong with being a subsistence farmer. It sounds like that's what small farms were like. Is that the experience you're starting to come to, that you feel that you just want to live and survive off your farm?
I would love to do that, but we're living in a different era, and you know, my health insurance alone is like $11,000 a year, and they don't cover anything. So it's like that's just, you know, before I go to the doctor. And
so you can't swap a jug of Scrumpy for health
insurance. No, you can't. And taxes are the same. And
you pay taxes as a farmer?
You do, especially in Lower New York when. This close to the city, and so yeah, we have to make some like grown-up money, which is hard to do when you just want to walk around foraging. So it's been a real challenge. That's trying to figure out how we can bridge the economy I want to live in with the sort of the old ways of doing things and what is now just this constant escalating cost of living. And so I think cider is a brilliant opportunity for particularly small producers for that. It's one of the Well, not yet. It's not been reduced to large-scale commoditization, as most people who drink cider tend to like the diversity and of all the different producers and all the different little lands and stuff like that. And that, of course, you can't scale up. So,
Ben?
Yeah, I think that the growth of cider has just been phenomenal over the past year. We were talking about 2010, 2011, and I've been trying to keep track since for the past 20 years or more of the cider producers in the country. And Andy was talking about just the growth in New York State, which has probably been more rapid, but just the sheer number all over the country. Was there probably 1,000 cider makers around the country now or more? And you can't keep track of it. It really is amazing at how organically it's grown, and then in the past few years, just how rapidly people have been coming in with really good stuff, too.
Ron, you're out there selling cider now. Yeah. So I was saying that one big change since 2011 is that more and more typical restaurants, mainstream bars and restaurants, have at least one line of cider. But you're out there competing against a lot of different types of ciders.
Yep, there are a lot of bigger brands we're always rotating with, trying to, you know, encourage people to shop local.
So even in Connecticut, you might be the local brand, but you're alternating with a national brand.
National brands, big brands, but we make it right there. So hopefully some restaurants realize staying nearby is good, and I think that they're picking up on that.
I was going to say, you at least have the advantage of not having national brands moving into your backyard and being, quote-unquote, local.
It's true.
Sorry for that.
Yeah,
there's a lot of big things at stake here.
People say, oh, you should sell in New York State. And I'm like, I could never compete with the ciders here.
We always like to say up
so
in
many great ones.
Sorry, we always used to say like to say up in New England that, you know, for years we were saying, you know, you're talking about the big national brands of cider, and it's like you realize that still, even now, cider is like just a pimple on the ass of the beer market. I mean, the beer market is so much bigger than cider, and it probably always will be, but it's your perspective changes when you get into the cider world.
No, and that's great. Hey, this is a great start. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a minute on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
All right. Hey. Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. Check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. It's our big summer membership push. You can become a member, business member, and a lot of benefits, including listening to great shows like this one. All right, heritageradionetwork.org. So we got Andy Brennan, author of Uncultivated, is editor, Ben Watson from Chelsea Green Publishing, and Ron Sansone from Spoke & Spy Cider in Connecticut, and we're drinking his cider. So, Ron, you're going to give us another cider. You said it was weird. We first had a single varietal, Kingston Black from Spoke & Spy.
I don't think it's that weird, but it's a blood orange pomegranate with pink lady apples. So it's a single variety with additional fruit.
Is that controversial, Andy?
Oh,
are you okay with mixing fruit?
Well, I make a mixed, I call it a fruit wine, which is a grape and
that's the Appanet.
I said the one with elderberry. So I mean, who am I to talk? Although obviously I'm an idealist, and I don't live up to my own ideals. So even if people hate me, I do too.
You know, talking about the evolution of the just the New York area cider market just since 2011 when Cider Week started. We were just talking about competition for draft handles. That's a whole new thing. I mean, that's kind of like cider cutting into beer. But I feel like that already now there's a big difference between the places that cider is sold and served, whether it's a bottle shop, a wine shop, or a restaurant, and you know, kind of like beer versus wine. It's almost like we're at that point now. Want to talk about that, Andy, in particular, like the choice you have of a distributor now. You're being distributed by wine distributors, not by a beer distributor. Do you see your approach as a little different than other cider makers? Because some, I feel like some ciders are being represented as a beer, sold on draft in a pint.
I think a lot varies greatly state to state, too. Mm-hmm. Just the way things are handled, the way the distributors do things. And I mean, I see yours as like shelved like wine. It's like almost completely different than where the other ciders are. So he
gets to be in a special place.
And yeah. The regulation's different from state to state.
Yeah. It affects things greatly.
Yeah, in New Hampshire, I testified before the legislature 1 year, and it didn't pass, but we were trying, a friend and I were trying to change the definition of cider, because if you had a really high quality, like a French cider that was 4%, I think we were trying to bring in Christian Drouin's cider from Normandy, wonderful cider, but it was 4% alcohol, and you were forced to go through the beer wholesalers because of the ABV on the cider. So there was a lot of misunderstanding back then about what cider is and how it's made. It really is more like a wine. I mean, if you want to talk about how to make it, than beer. But there's always been that sort of confusion, you know, for a long time, really for 100 years or more. I mean, draft ciders, you know, were thought of more like casks of beer or something like that in England. You know, that still persists. I mean, is it beer or is it wine? Well, it's neither. It's cider. It's a different animal, different cat.
Ron, I know you got your love of cider from London, didn't you?
Yeah, I went to school in London, drank a lot of cider, came home. Now I'm making it. So.
And what were the ciders that you were drinking there like that inspired you?
It was just in pubs, draft ciders. Not too crazy. I didn't have a car. Couldn't get out to the scrumpy lands, but I've gone back and went to Herefordshire and visited all the great cider makers. It's definitely inspirational.
Let's talk about the inspirational styles of cider. So, Andy, I know you're making things like Apinet, which is like your mixed fruit drink. But a couple years ago, we had a party in Brooklyn, and you brought your scrumpy. You know, what is scrumpy, and why make it? And it seems like it's something that people really like.
Well, my definition of scrumpy may not be the same as where the word originated in, which is the southwest portion of England, known as the West Country. And my understanding of scrumpy, at least in that tradition, I've never been. Maybe you could speak to this one. Is the locals show up with big jugs and fill it up?
Yeah, it's pretty raw, pretty strong. It kind of gets you in the gut.
Yeah, and I mean, the etymology of it is the word scrump, to scrump. The verb to scrump just means, essentially, you're going around and gleaning somebody's apples after they've fallen off the tree, and either they don't want them or you get to them before the tree's owners get to them, and you're making scrumpy out of apples that you've scrumped.
Which wouldn't be illegal in America, because you can't work with drops.
Right, well, technically.
But so scrumpy. But you make it, Andy, and it's really good. To you, it was a treasured item that you brought to this event that you said, what, you only sell through your CSA or your...
So that's what we drink at home. So when we're bottling, we try our best, although if you look at our bottles, you'd think I was lying, to actually not pull up as much yeast from the, known as the lees, at the bottom of the barrels before bottling. And you leave behind about 1/20th of that barrel, and you have in some years up to 30 barrels. So 1/20th of 30 barrels is over a barrel, and we just mix it all together, and that's what we drink at home. And we don't drink so much. or we didn't. And
it's very farmerly. Like you're basically drinking the dregs yourself, and you're selling the rest, yeah. Right?
Yeah, and the thing about I was interested in the book too. That you know, lees are incredibly healthy too, with all the yeast in there, and you sell to, you're providing lees to Blue Hill, right?
Yeah, yeah. They still do. They pick up. I make now the really thick yeast at the bottom of the ciders. Now I pour all the lees into one container and let that settle. And then above that is what I drink. And then the really thick stuff I use to culture my own yeast. And I have about 20 or 30 of these 1 gallon jugs of really thick stuff. And usually when I'm culturing my yeast for the following year, I'll just take a sip from that bottle and see which is the one I like the most, and that's kind of the starter for the year. But that means I have a 19 left over, and Dan Barber, and then Blue Hill was he came up with this recipe for braising pork. And I was a vegetarian, so I don't even really know what he was doing. But so we went, we went and did a little talk to the staff there, and they brought out the what they had made from the scrumpy, and it was just it was
scrumpy, super yeasty lees.
It's super yeasty lees, and there's a tradition of using it in France and even in Canada for things like soup stocks and salad dressings. Yeah,
that's great. And Ben, you know, in your work as an editor, you said you had another book out by a Canadian cider maker. What is different about the Quebec approach? Traditions.
It's another tradition. I mean, it's a long standing tradition in Quebec too. I mean, it's a great food culture up there, obviously, with all kinds of fermentation. You know, breads and cheese and ciders and beers. That they make up there. But this fellow, Claude Jolicoeur, did a book that we published a few years ago through Chelsea Green called The New Cider Maker's Companion, or The New Cider Maker's Handbook, rather. And it's really a good primer for people who are a little bit more serious than the people who bought my book. I mean, mine was focused on people who just wanted to make it at home. I just wanted to get people started. You know, throw it in a jug. Here's the basics. You don't need to make a big investment. And Claude goes the further step beyond in terms of testing and the scientific rationale of this thing. And I think a lot of, I don't know, Ron can maybe speak to it too, that whether it's useful or not. But I think a lot of people have mentioned to me that they thought that was a book that needed to be written.
Yeah, Claude's book has a lot of like DIY projects. If you're trying to scale up your home production, has like graphs, charts, yep. Lots of really great stuff.
And Ben, also, just give a shout out to Chelsea Green Publishing. So you guys, I mean, we've had on the Laura Tenike, the Hop Growers Handbook. You've got a lot of kind of aggy farming. I think Michael Foley's book, Farming.
Edited that book too.
What's the full title of that?
Farming for the Long Haul.
Yeah, there was a lot of similarities between what he said and what Andy's saying.
Yeah, I mean, his book is really a fascinating book about what we can learn from indigenous and peasant farmers and maybe lessons we can all learn to make agriculture more regenerative and moving forward as we have climate challenges and things. But yeah, we do a lot of books on ag, and we also do food books. And one of the areas that we focused on years ago was we had this wild guy, Sandor Katz, show up at our offices, our old office.
Everybody knows him.
And he came in with this saddle-stitched little book that he called Wild Fermentation. And he said, you know, and he brought in a jar of kraut that he had made, and we passed it around and ate with our hands out of the jar. And we said, we got to publish this book. And that was, geez, I don't know, 20 years ago. And since then, we've really focused on all things fermented. That's really sort of our niche. So we've got books on, making mead like a Viking, brew beer like a Yeti, you know. And most of them are how-to. As you say, Andy's book really isn't a how-to. It's a really deep, fascinating study into, you know, wild apples and cider. But it isn't isn't going to tell you how to make cider, at least not directly.
You know, your book, Andy, Uncultivated, it's not a how-to. It's almost a how-not-to, because I had a nightmare. I started reading it the other night, and I had a night. It was more of a vivid dream, and I could feel the stress of as you were learning about things. I mean, gosh, you must have been, your ass was on the line so many times.
Yeah,
well, and you were able to survive this.
Well, we started. You know, my background professionally was in architecture. So when we started what was then the cidery in 2008, it was during that economic crash, and as you know, that was the housing market was heavily affected, and so. And then we had just moved as well, so our entire investment, our life savings basically was in a property, which immediately plummeted in values. So yeah, we had a lot of stress going on. If you sense that in the book, I just say welcome to my world, because I still am very stressed, and I never. Feel like I'm on top of things or have things figured out.
Well, when I was at your place, it was 2016. You know, you walked the hillside with us. You showed us how you had put the crushed pumice on the ground, and you had seedlings growing up. It was pretty. That was eye opening to me. I had assumed that my grandfather was kind of did his own small farming, and he pruned trees. So I figured that most cider orchards look like pruned trees, and grafting was going on. I didn't know that this was really how trees grew, apple trees grew in particular. Tell us about the moment in the book when you discovered that was really your destiny, this big birth of tree moment. You saw old cider trees that were thriving in an area where you couldn't really plant things to grow.
Yeah, this is true. Like I mentioned earlier, I live on the edge of the Hudson Valley and the Catskills, and the Hudson Valley is world famous for apple production, but it's a particular type of apple production. And in fact, there might be as many wild apples in the Catskills as there are farmed apples in the Hudson Valley, but you would never know it. You know, this relates to the economy, and we expect a lot out of farms and apples, and so the advice from the experts for me as I was starting out growing apples was solely based on the information of those farmed apples, and what the experts know about that particular thing. I mean, it's the analogy I use early in the book is the wolf and the dog. The difference between say that Paris Hilton dog and a wolf is a good analogy between a farmed apple and a wild apple. And I live in the land of wild apples, and everybody, including the local Cornell station, just completely overlooked it.
You know, but your approach, I mean, when I, you know, studied wine for years, and when you talk about the best wines in the world, we're talking about making the best ciders in the world. We're not just talking about making a beverage. When you talk about making the best wines in the world, people recognize that there's certain terroirs, there's certain types of grapes, there's certain places where the wines grow better, and there's also realized that there's a limited yield. So are people getting that in the cider industry? Are consumers realizing that there's a hierarchy of better ciders, better cider makers? Do you feel like you're in that hierarchy?
I don't feel like I'm in that hierarchy. I have this reputation for being in it. I believe solely isn't from my skill as a cider maker as much as it is the apples. I would give that, you know, there was there's the Diane Flints and the Steve and Lulus and the Terry Maloney's. I really Eve Cidery is another great one. I feel like they're approaching it at a higher level than myself. I kind of myself am more involved with what I think of as sort of a the home production, but using an apple which just happens to be, I think, superior.
Ben? I was going to say that, you know, we talked about this a little off the air, but it isn't always easy for people to grow apples. Like, we tried the Kingston Black Cider, and I know that apple grows well for some people, but it's a really fussy apple to grow. And these are European cider apples that people have brought over. And Andy talks about, you know, considering them in his business early on. But, you know, using the seedling naturalized apples, place-based apples, they not only can be more disease resistant naturally, but also better adapted to the area. And also they're sort of becoming, I think a lot of people are realizing in the cider world, our North American cider apples. And if we could discover more of them before they're all gone and really evaluate them, even people who aren't, you know, foraging them, we could find new varieties just like they used to do, you know, 200 years ago or 150 years ago. And come up with a new class of North American cider apples. And I think that's, to a certain extent, what Andy is doing and what Shaxbury and other people have done. And I find that very interesting. And some people don't get it, or they don't think it's worthwhile. Other people think, yeah, this is legitimate. Let's see where this goes. Let's experiment.
Great. And Ron, we're enjoying your cider. How did you decide to make ciders with other fruits besides apples? Where's your sources coming from? You know, you're in Connecticut, you're kind of a pioneer there.
It's definitely not local. I mean, the Pink Lady apples were from Connecticut, but everything else is not local. So I just kind of look toward cocktails, mixology, what's going on, what's trendy. I mean, you got to keep up with that. It's different than if I had wild apples, I would just do that.
But we should go to. We can go to Middletown, Connecticut, yeah, near Wesleyan University.
I have no trees.
But you have
no pineapple trees.
You have a tasting room.
No pineapples. No.
You have a tasting room.
We have a tasting room, and it's always interesting things.
So. And a lot of it really is. This is Ben again.
And let's pour one more. A lot of it.
I'm really fascinated by the difference in marketing, and a lot of it, like everything else, is driven by marketing and what people's expectations are. And for a long time, people's expectations were, well, cider needs to be appley and sweet. It needs to taste like apple juice, and it needs to be sweet, and it needs to be, you know, a certain flavor profile. And I think even though, you know, they're mixing in different fruits and doing different things, I don't think there's that perception anymore. There are sour ciders, and there are wild ciders, wild, you know, natural yeast ciders, and it's a much, much bigger universe now.
And I think that also relates a lot to the foraging and the spreading of pumice and letting trees grow up. I mean, the diversity of apples produce, you know, there's still so many things that we've never tasted if we allow trees to grow the way they're supposed to grow. John Bunker, who is, deserves a shout-out, I think, he runs Fedco Trees in Maine, but he's always been a great apple hound. And there's some just insane varieties that he brings to Cider Days every year that nobody's ever had. Nobody would ever think an apple could taste like that.
And if we're on the trail, remember there was that Stalking the Wild Asparagus. If we're on the trail of the wild apple, I know that in the Finger Lakes region, there's some old national forests where there's happened to be, they got lucky, there's a bunch of trees, wild trees, and near your area and up in Maine, there's, how much of our Northeast has wild apples, and are there pockets that we should be protecting or be paying attention to?
My own experience is, the Catskills are, like I said, they're a gold mine, but I grew up near West Virginia, and I know them to grow well there, but I've never seen a place like the coast of Maine. And even in the high tide mark, you'll find apple trees growing on cliffs. But I would say everything from Quebec probably down to Kentucky and maybe even the mountains of North Carolina, where we're living in one of the greatest apple places in the world. And if the apple has the ability to escape the farm and go wild, I mean, what better proof do you need to know that we're like, this is it. This is the place where we should be growing apples.
Yeah, I mean, they're everywhere, really. I mean, I just, as I said, I just moved recently and to another town. And during springtime, you notice the apples and you don't see them virtually any other time of the year. But in a good year, when you get blossoms and they don't get frozen out, you just say, I never knew there was an apple tree there. You're just driving around in the country, and they really are everywhere that there used to be farming, which was almost everywhere at one time. And I think that the value of them, we talk about, well, why are these any good? I mean, a lot of them really taste awful, but they taste awful because they have natural tannins in them. And so they're bitter, just like the bittersweet and bitter sharp varieties that you get from England and Europe. But they're ones that grow over here, and they've got genetic diversity, and that's what results in, you know, these guys can talk more about it than I can, but it results in structure, you know, to the cider, and it really makes a more interesting drink.
And lastly, Ron, this last cider you pour, Spoken Spy, what is it? There's some grape in here.
It's grape. It's a grape cider.
Grape cider. It's a nice different drink.
It's very easy to drink, 5.1%. People seem to like it.
And to wrap it up, I mean, we do more and more cider episodes on Beer Sessions Radio. Look back, that name John Bunker, we did a show with him 2015. Ben Watson, we did a show with him 2015. We've had Ron on a couple times. We've had a number of State of the Cider and Cider Week episodes. And our great series, On the Road with Beer Sessions Radio, we're with a number of cider makers, including Andy Brennan and John Reynolds up at Black Duck in Finger Lakes. So there's a lot of knowledge out there on our show. So keep checking it out on Heritage Radio Network. Just Google Cider and Heritage Radio Network, and you can see a lot of our shows. But thank you guys for coming on. If anyone wants to say anything else, last chance for comments. But otherwise, I would say, what's the name of the book, Ben?
Uncultivated.
And the subtitle is actually Ben's contribution. Wild Apples, Real Cider, and the Complicated Art of Making a Living.
And the last question is, in the book you said you had a Toyota, but on the cover of the book there's a Ford. So
that's the dump truck.
You got a dump truck.
Yeah.
Last question. Okay, so in the book, this is a quiz for Andy, you had a small pickup truck. How many bushels would fill the back of that pickup truck when you're out there foraging?
A little tiny truck like the Toyota, about a bin, which is like 19, 20 bushels, equivalent of about 800 pounds.
How long would that take you?
On a good year, a half a day. On a bad year, a month. Last year, I made one barrel from foraged fruit.
And Ben, it's been interesting. I mean, and there's a whole other show is making the book. I know you're the editor, and you guys work closely together. But thank you guys. I really recommend it. If you like to read, it's not a how-to book. It's a reading book. If you're interested in small farms and struggles and, a new vision for what apple making is, read the book Uncultivated. But I'll shout out this. Guys, Andy's just catching up. I mean, wine's already been there. Natural wine is all the craze. People are like, oh, this is how my grandparents made wine, and now we're coming back to it. So if you're interested in natural wine, you go to the raw wine fests. Well, there are cider makers doing it, and Andy's book will be right in that discussion with you guys. So check it out, Uncultivated, Chelsea Green Publishing. And thanks so much for joining me, everybody here. Ben Watson, Ron Sansone, Andy Brennan, I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us. Big shout out to producer Justin Kennedy, engineer Matt Patterson, assistant producer Aaliyah Papes. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks for joining us on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll catch you next time on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.